Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Sarah Gerard, author of Carrie Carolyn Coco, My Friend, Her Murder, and An Obsession with the Unthinkable. Listeners, before I continue on with the description of this book, I just wanted to make note that this conversation is about murder and the details surrounding a murder, so please do take note and take care. In 2016, 25-year-old Carolyn Bush was brutally stabbed to death in her New York City apartment by her roommate, Render Stetson Shanahan, leaving friends and family of both of these roommates reeling. In life, Carolyn was a gregarious, smart-mouthed, aspiring poet who had seemingly gotten along well with Render. Writer Esme Wang writes of the book, "Sarah Gerard unravels poison in the dark corners of Carolyn Bush's world, a fancy liberal arts college with a chilling history of violence, the violence in Bush's everyday existence, and the web of people who are willing to stand up for Bush's murderer, some with dubious motives." Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. There is a lot to tackle when it comes to the aboutness of Carrie Carolyn Coco, but I want to begin our conversation with Carolyn herself. And I'm going to ask you what I imagine is a really difficult and big question. Who was Carolyn Bush?
She was a 25-year-old woman with huge aspirations, trying to make it in New York City. She was a scholar, a community organizer, a sister, a friend, a comedian. She was hoping to pursue a PhD in poetry or medieval studies or comparative literature or some combination thereof. She was an expat of St. Petersburg, Florida, which is also my hometown. She was punk rock. She was a fashionista, just a huge multifaceted conglomeration of personality and wit and style.
As you said, Carolyn was a poet living in New York, and as you set out to do in this book, you are looking at and investigating her murder. She was brutally stabbed by her roommate, Render Stetson Shanahan, in 2016. He pled insanity during his trial, claiming that his use of marijuana right before the murder led to something like a psychotic break. Mm-hmm. But as much as that story, the story of Carolyn's murder, is maybe interesting or intriguing or reason enough to write this book, you mention early on in the book that you want to center Carolyn's life, not Render's. And you do write about him in the nearly 350 pages of the book. There is plenty in there about Render, but you really do center Carolyn and her experiences, her friends, her family, these people that she spent significant time with. And this decision seems like maybe an easy one on the outset, but I'm wondering how you created or how you navigated that balance between writing about Carolyn and Render when their lives were so intertwined by her death.
Well, I'm glad you said that their lives were intertwined, because I had a sense early on that by retracing Carolyn's steps, I could pinpoint where their lives intersected and why she died the way she did. And that turned out to be true to an extent. I uncovered some pivotal moments where, you know, that where Carolyn decided, for instance, to have a roommate in New York City instead of just Airbnb-ing the second room in her apartment to pay the rent. In fact, she continued doing that after he moved in, and I think that was also really important. It came up in the trial, as you know. She also had a stalker, somebody that she met while she was living in the Hudson Valley, going to Bard College. I think that was another determining factor in her decision to have a roommate. She felt safer with someone else in the house. Ironically, that person would later kill her. But Carolyn's dad said something that rang very true to me during one of our interviews. He said he chose not to attend the murder trial because the trial was about Render. It wasn't about Carolyn. And I hated that. When I was figuring out how to organize the book, I could have spent a lot more time just talking about Render, but I thought that because a large portion of the book is comprised of the trial material, that would sort of do the job for me. It's true, because he was right. Her dad was right. Everything that came up in that trial was about Render, wasn't about Carolyn. So I didn't really need to spend 10 more chapters unpacking the nuances of his disturbed mind when the trial was doing that for me. I did want to talk a bit about his background growing up in the Hudson Valley and his family and their close relationship with Bard College, and several administrators and faculty members of Bard wrote letters of support for Render. So I really wanted to look at that. But the majority of my research went into telling Carolyn's life story. So I interviewed her family, her friends, her former teachers, employers, from New York, from Florida. I visited places where she used to live in the Hudson Valley and in Florida, photographed those places. I found her middle school yearbooks and read her college application essays and researched her family and their lineage. And I really just wanted to know who she was, what led her to leave Florida and move to Annandale-on-Hudson, New York, to study literature at Bard. What made her then leave Bard and move to New York City and enroll at the New School, and to continue her education there? Who was she dating? Where was she hanging out? What were the readings that she was going to? Who was she listening to? The music that she was listening to. What were the books that she was reading? And what did this all say about her state of mind, at every step of her life? I wanted to learn her, like I wanted to, like as if Carolyn were some kind of language. Like I wanted to learn the language of Carolyn so that I could write the story in her voice to the extent that's possible.
The subtitle of your book is My Friend, Her Murder, and an Obsession with the Unthinkable. And I want to focus for just a minute on this idea that she was your friend. You knew Carolyn. This wasn't just some person you read about in a newspaper. And I want to talk about that idea that you are a writer and you're writing about someone you know, publishing a long book about someone you know. And I'm going to ramble a little bit at you before I ask this question, but in a chapter titled Grieving Giver Riven River, you write about Carolyn's friend Matt. He had written an essay about her shortly after her death and shared it publicly at a reading series. And in this passage, he begins asking himself about writing as a way to process grief, asking himself, does all of this have to get turned into writing? Another friend of Carolyn's, Rachel, asks, what does it mean to write about someone's death? And this chapter that these two passages are found in, they see you questioning this impulse as well, questioning your motivations. You've written, I knew nothing about how to write about murder or how to not write about it. I needed to know what motivated other people so I could figure out what was motivating me. So I'm wondering, Sarah, if you can pinpoint it. It sounds like you just wanted to know Carolyn, and I think you even say that specific phrase, I wanted to know Carolyn, in this chapter. But talk about your motivations for writing the book, how it intersects your need to process her death in grief. what guidelines you gave yourself for this book, what guided you. Will you talk about that? That's a lot packaged into a single question, but maybe you can unpack it for me.
A lot of people along the way warned me against writing this book, or warned me against writing it in a particular way that could be exploitative. And I was really grateful for those warnings. And I tried to be really careful not to turn this story into something like 24 Hours Mystery and or, you know, some kind of CSI show. And because, you know, I always had a sense that people were kind of watching me along the way as I was doing this work, people who knew Carolyn and loved her, incredibly smart people and sensitive people, ethical people. I knew they were going to hold me accountable. And I'm really glad they did. And people like Adjua, Carolyn's really close friend, I saw her taking a hard look at herself in the aftermath of this murder and asking herself, you know, why have I been watching all these true crime shows and treating them as entertainment when there's so much pain in them? I was also looking at myself and asking similar questions. And I write in the book, I wasn't really a reader of true crime when I decided to write this book. And, you know, now I'm back in school getting a second master's degree and I'm studying criminal justice. So I'm reading a lot about crime and why people commit crimes. But that was not the case when I started out here. I was curious why this happened, but mostly I was grieving for the people around me who were my friends and people I cared deeply about and saw suffering because Carolyn had been lost so brutally, and they were sort of, you know, they were in a state of shock. And also looking at the world around them, this is right before Trump was elected, and seeing just so much violence and brutality. They had, you know, a sense that they were unsafe in the world, and so did I. And these are very politically minded people as well. So I think already I could see sort of the larger implications of a crime like this playing out on a cultural, societal level, a political level. And see the continuum of violence against women and this as just one part of that continuum. So, you know, and I knew Carolyn. She was my friend. I care a lot about her, but I was not as close to her as other people. I also, as a writer, know, you know, just how hard it is to write about something like this. Write about somebody really close to you as it's happening, you know? I mean, I think I wanted to sort of do my part as a member of the community in preserving the pieces of Carolyn that I was seeing, reading about online, reading, you know, or hearing people talk about. I wanted to kind of capture those stories in amber for a later time when I could do something with them, you know, do something sort of productive with them. And I wanted the world to know Carolyn too. It's just so unfair that she never got to fully self-actualize and achieve the goals that she was setting for herself. So I wanted to know who she would have been. I wanted to know her more as she was when she was here with us on Earth. And I also wanted to be able to talk to my friends about her, and for us to be able to process this together, feel this together. So that was, I think I had a lot of different motivations, I suppose.
Yeah. How did you come to the structure of the book, the certain tone? Because I think it's been marketed as sort of true crime meets memoir, but I don't even know if I would go so far as to say memoir, because it doesn't center you in the way that a memoir would. So can you talk about the way that you came to I guess, a voice and the structure of the book, because it does, as I said at the beginning, it goes in so many different places. There is a lot to talk about.
I never thought of this as a memoir, and I've been sort of surprised when people use that word, because I mean, I do appear in the book briefly in some places, but I am not even one of the main characters. I'm sort of a background tertiary character in the book. And I've written memoir, as you know, but yeah, this is very different to my mind, and it just has a different set of rules. I think it went through such an intense fact check and legal read is because it's not a memoir, and I'm not just talking about my own experience or my own perspective on things, although I will admit that it's not an unbiased work. I do have a bias, and I was very transparent about my bias as I was going about this research, because I never wanted anybody to mistake my intentions. I was Carolyn's friend. I attended the trial on her. I sat with her family on the side of the courtroom, claimed by her family. I never even got to interview Render's family. Although I reached out to them, they responded through their lawyers. And I mean, I met his brother very briefly, but he started crying and said, "I can't talk to you." And not that I wanted to be insensitive to Render's family. It's not their fault this happened, but I'm not close with that. I feel no allegiance to them at all. I feel a lot of allegiance to Carolyn's family and friends, and I consider myself one of them. So maybe it's because of that bias that people are thinking, you know, thinking of this in the vein of memoir. But I mean, every journalist has bias, right? I think, and I even said that to Render, like, look, this is an outdated idea. This idea that journalists are totally unbiased, that's just not where we are in human history anymore. So, I reached this form because, or I guess I should say, I found this voice because the work is so research heavy, probably, and I really wanted to foreground the facts, and also really wanted to foreground the voices of people who were closest to Carolyn and could tell her story. I guess by that, I mean, I really wanted to foreground Carolyn, not myself. And the people who could tell her story are those closest to her and people who were a part of her story. So in moments where I was a part of the story and it warranted a scene, I appeared. But in those moments where I wasn't present for something happening or wasn't central to whatever was happening, even if I was present, you know, I took a back seat. Like in the vigil chapter, I was there for that. And I could talk about the feeling in the room and what was being served. And, you know, like, you know, there was whiskey and there was a cheese plate and the music that was playing and stuff, because I was there. But I only got up to speak for a couple minutes and then I sat back down and other people got up to speak. So that's sort of a metaphor for the book, I guess, the form of the book.
You're listening to A Conversation with Sarah Gerard. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley, providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapteronebookstore.com. I want to go back to Bard College. Carolyn attended Bard College for a couple of years. She ended up dropping out. But one of the most startling things that you bring to light in this book is Bard's sort of hands-off philosophy that their administrators have towards the well-being of their students outside of the classroom. You've cited the president of Bard College. He wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times. He writes, "Myths die hard, especially those that appear to symbolize the purposes and identity of a college." His philosophies about education and the role of administrators at Bard are really, really prominent in this book. When you set out to write Carolyn's story, did you know that obviously Bard was going to be a character in the book? She went to Bard. She met so many of the characters in this book at Bard. I'm curious about how you considered the role moving forward through the research process, kind of discovering these really severe scenarios, circumstances, these things that happened at Bard that influenced not only Carolyn and her experience there, but sort of creates this kind of terrifying setting for gender-based violence. So will you talk a little bit about that, how you discovered it, and then the role that you wanted it to play in the book?
Yes, I didn't expect Bard to play the role that it did. When I started doing this research, it slowly emerged through dozens of interviews as a more prominent figure. Quite a few people who knew Carolyn through Bard described her murder as a Bard incident, as something that was intricately tied to her history at Bard, even though it happened 4 years after she left in New York City, which is 100 miles away from Bard. And the more I interviewed people, the more I realized this was an important part of her story. I knew that I was going to tell her story, her life story. So I knew that a couple of years would take place at Bard College and it would be an important setting. It was a very formative place for her in different ways. I did not know how Leon Botstein would figure in until 2020, June 2020, in fact. I didn't even know who he was until around that time. I found out who Leon Botstein was when Render's lawyer at his sentencing pointed out to the judge how he had written this letter of support for Render in 2020 prior to his sentencing, asking for leniency. And I could see in the sentencing, which by the way took place over Zoom, so I could see everybody's faces, I could see the shock on people's faces and sort of disgust on people's faces. And I believe it was Danielle Sine who actually sent me that letter that he had written, because she promptly resigned from the Bard Alumni Board of Governors. She was one of Carolyn's classmates and close friends at Bard, and her grandfather is on Bard's Board of Trustees and is a close friend of Leon Botstein's. So Danielle resigned from the Alumni Board of Governors, and then Leon heard about that through the grapevine and emailed Danielle and her grandparents the letter, and with a note saying, "I stand by what I said and what I did, and I wrote this in the spirit of my own daughter who died at the age of 7, nearly 8, in I believe it was 1981. She was hit by a car while she was waiting for the school bus, and then Danielle forwarded his email and that letter to me. So at that point, I did not realize that twice since Render had been arrested in 2017 and in 2020, 9 people, which to be fair, include his mother who works at Bard also, she's the director of graduate admissions, 9 people from Bard had written letters of support for him to the courts on Bard letterhead, many of them on Bard letterhead saying, you know, "In my capacity as Dean of Students at Bard College, I am writing in support of Render Setson Shanahan," or "In my capacity as the Spanish professor or director of the Writing Center or the Learning Commons at Bard," or, I mean, many of these people also knew Carolyn and don't even mention her in these letters, barely at all. So I would only learn that later through a records request, a FOIA request. And I made two FOIA requests, by the way. I when I wrote the first FOIA request, didn't I was only asking for the letters that had been written in 2020 because I didn't realize that letters had also been written in 2017 before Render was even indicted. So, which is kind of amazing to me. It was also before he had even seen a psychologist, that they were writing and saying he had experienced psychosis or that he had some other sort of mental break. And how could they know that unless they had been told by his mother or, you know, that there's just no way that they could know otherwise. So and when I it was at that point that I knew something fishy was going on and dug started to dig deeper. And meanwhile, I had been I continued interviewing people. I was interviewing people probably once or twice a week this whole time, for hours and hours and hours. And many of those people were current or former students or faculty or administrators at Bard. And I was also combing through Bard's archives, the archives of the Bard Observer, archives of the Bardian, and the Bardvark, and reading about, and also like the New York Times archives, reading Leon's many op-eds for the New York Times, and read his book in which he talks about this philosophy of treating students as adults when they turn 15, you know, when they get, when they, his philosophy says that, you know, basically when a girl gets her period, she's an adult. And,
Which, for listeners, our eventual listeners, plays into ideas of consent, obviously, in context.
yeah. So it was all, none of it was really what I wanted for the book, or what I had imagined at the outset. It just happened that way. You know, to a large extent, the story told by the reporting was out of my hands. It was just what I found. Again, speaking to the facts and what they convey. And just listening to what people were say, people who were very familiar with Bard, its culture and its philosophy, and Leon personally, what they were saying to me about their own experiences.
Well, thank you for sharing Carolyn with the world through this book, Sarah. It was such a engaging and tragic reading experience. I can't deny that, but yeah, I so enjoyed getting to know her through you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sarah Gerard, author of Carrie, Carolyn, Coco. My Friend, Her Murder, and An Obsession with the Unthinkable, out now from Zando Books. Sarah is also the author of the essay collection Sunshine State, the novella Binary Star, two chapbooks, and the novel True Love. She lives in Denver, Colorado. Look for more information about Sarah at mtpr.org, where you can also listen to this conversation again or share it with friends. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.